Joining me now is composer Shinji Ejima, who's created a work for the San Francisco Ballet, Raku, the score for a work, I should say. It premiered last year, and it's back into the repertory this season. Welcome to KALW.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
And I didn't realize until I read up a little bit that you are also a double bass player and play in the ballet orchestra.
Yes, that's true. Have been for 30 years.
That's quite a while.
I play in the opera as well, and this is a real treat for me to come out of the pit and do something on for the stage.
Well, and I read somewhere that you had actually given Yuri Posikov many, many scores over the years, and he finally, or ideas at least, and finally came up with one that he liked.
Well, that's somewhat true. What actually happened was when he came up with the idea for this ballet half a year before the premiere, through the process of creating the ballet, I'd given him tons and tons of music. He actually asked me in June of 2010 and wanted a 45-minute score 3 months later.
Wow.
And so trying to put together that much music and ideas. So, yeah, I actually offered him twice that much, and he discarded what he didn't like, but he was right to do that.
So what's the basic idea behind it? What's the story?
It's based on a true story of a Zen monk in Japan who lived at the Kinkakuji in Kyoto, and all of a sudden, in 1950, a lot of people think that this is an ancient story, but it actually happened post-war. And this monk burned down what is considered to be the most beautiful temple in all of Japan. And it became rather infamous as Yukio Mishima, one of the top writers of Japan, also wrote a story called The Temple of the Golden Pavilion. And in that book, he speculates on why the Zen monk might have burned down what is called the Golden Pavilion, because it's literally made out of gold. And in this ballet, we take a slightly different stance on why he burned it down. Nobody actually knows. He did survive the burning and questioned heavily, but he never revealed his intention. And in this story, we take the position that perhaps he fell in love with just an unbelievably beautiful princess and could not control himself, and in his frustration and inability to gain the heart of this princess, he burns the temple down. The ballet was originally conceived of for the principal ballet star Yuan Yuan Tan, and sort of woven around her is how this ballet was created.
Well, now, what is the process of the creation? Obviously, you don't just go off by yourself. You have some interaction with Yuri along the way?
Very much so.
And because he knows, I guess, well, he said 45 minutes, okay? So he had a scenario of what he wanted to portray?
He had this story. It was actually a friend, a close friend of Yuan Yuan, who offered this adaptation of this true story. And Yuri decided he would do a ballet based on this story. And he had an outline for it, therefore, a storyline. He knew he wanted to incorporate samurai and a scene that incorporated ashes and some cranes that symbolized the death of these samurai. And therefore, he had kind of the arc of a storyline. That's what he offered to me. He told me he wanted a pas de deux, he wanted variations, he wanted a scene with warriors, he wanted fight scenes. He was very specific and told me that he wanted certain sections to go start slow and go faster to develop, and he said no more than three climaxes, too. But no, he was very, very specific with what he wanted, and he wanted a romantic score, a tonal score, but he also did not want even meters. He wanted things that were slightly different. And so I would bring him suggestions and examples of writings, and he would either say, yes, that's good, or no, can this be longer, shorter? He was even specific enough to say in the first a part of the Warriors, that he wanted it in an ABA format and form. He had certain scenes in mind, so we needed music for that, to little side stories. He's very, very much a person who works from his feelings on a gut level, and he just instantly knows what he wants, and vice versa, instantly knows what he doesn't like.
Have you ever created a score with this kind of commission before?
No. I've written music, mainly chamber music, in the past. This is my first work for full orchestra. Well, you can imagine my surprise. I've been playing in the orchestra for over 30 years, and the only thing that I can think of is Yuri knew that this story was based on a Japanese true event, and thinking that here I am, Japanese looking in the pit, that maybe I would be able to come up with something. And that's actually what happened. A close mutual friend referred him to me, and when he offered it, I could not turn down the opportunity, although I had less than 3 months to write something. But to come out of the pit and create a ballet for San Francisco Ballet, you know, like the world's greatest ballet company, and with who is considered one of the top choreographers now in the world, and for the top dancers, certainly, with Yuan Yuantan and Pascal Molat dancing, it was, I couldn't say no.
You couldn't refuse, yeah.
No, I was scared. And I have to say, it was a huge leap of faith on the part of Helgi Thomason to allow a member of his orchestra to come out and produce something. I mean, just an enormous amount of trust. And when the music director, Martin West, requested to review it, he was asked, you know, to check this guy out and see if it's a viable thing. I have to also thank him very much, because after listening to a few of my works, he gave the okay.
Well, and they've produced a nice recording of it, too, with a ballet orchestra.
That is just the most phenomenal and miraculous thing to have occurred, because the orchestra themselves had to take a special vote in order to do it, and they did it on a date when we already had a recording session. And so they voted to deviate in such a way that they would perform an extra service in order to produce this recording. And I did write it for them, and there are a lot of solos that are written specifically for certain people who I've worked with now for so long. They're really close friends and really more like family. And in the score, I do name them, and that this selection melody was written for specific people. But that it happened at all is just miraculous. That it would happen at Skywalker is even more miraculous, because it's the greatest sound studio in the world. And strangely, oddly enough, the ballet was the first orchestra to record in that studio when it was built. I think in about 87, our Nutcracker, they actually wanted an orchestra to try out and to tune their recording studio. So it was serendipitous that we said, great, we want to do a recording. And we were actually the first orchestra back then to try that out.
I didn't realize that
studio.
Yeah. Well, we've got to hear some of this. What should we listen to from this score?
Well, perhaps we could start at the end, because it's based on that a theme that was written for the Hiroshima anniversary, and it features David Katarash, the solo cellist, and Yuri wanted solo cello for this moment.
All right, let's listen to it.
Thank you.
And that's the final scene from Raku, the ballet score by our guest Shinji Eshima for the San Francisco Ballet, back in the repertoire now. Gosh, that's a beautiful score. I think this recording could stand on its own without being from a ballet.
Well, that's very kind of you. And I was lucky enough to get a nice review that said virtually the same thing. So, but thanks.
So for your first orchestral score, that's amazing.
Well,
and done in 3 months.
And we did the recording in one take. Because
wow.
we only had time for that one opportunity. And you can hear it in this recording, the dedication, the commitment of the members. But I was lucky enough to have all of them, virtually this entire orchestra, as my teacher. Because I can go to them, ask them any question, is this possible to play? Can I score it this way? And I've also been listening to them for the past 30 years, so
right.
I know what they can sound like. And that proved, you know, to be really a source of inspiration.
Well, when did you start composing, or have you always composed?
I've always wanted to. Certainly for the past 20 years, I've been doing it. It's just a ridiculous dream to have a piece that you compose performed by this orchestra in the opera house. I mean, I grew up around this opera house, and it's definitely the high point of my life to walk out on the stage and see this ballet company perform and get an interpretation, and such a beautiful one, of your work is, I still can't believe it, really. A year later, and the fact that it's coming again, and they're taking it on tour now, and it's phenomenal. I still really can't believe it.
Well, how did you start composing? Why did you start composing? Because was the bass your first instrument?
I started off as a kid on piano.
Ah.
In Berkeley, I grew up here. Played in the Junior Bach Festival. I was terrified of 88 keys when I went to the piano. And the bass later became something that I thought was easier because it was one line at a time. I was very lucky and managed to get the right teachers. And it was never my intention to become a bass player, but I just sort of ended up that way and was lucky enough to get a job with both the ballet and the opera. But I've always sort of been tinkering around with wanting to compose. And I've always written things for my friends who we'd get together and play little chamber music and local concerts. But to jump from that into something of this scale was the luck of a lifetime, really.
But there's not much chamber music that involves a double bass, is there?
You'd be surprised. There was 10 years ago, there was more music written for the double bass than there were for all the other string instruments combined.
Really?
Yeah, yeah.
Is that Gary Carr's influence? Or?
That's a lot to do with Gary Carr, to be sure, who is the first president of the International Society of Basses. And we actually held the ISB convention here in San Francisco this past summer.
Oh.
I was one of the hosts, and we had, if you can believe it, 1,400 bass players from around the world here in San Francisco, all playing everything that you can imagine. But it's come into its own as an instrument.
Now, I read something about the particular instrument that you play. Tell us about it.
Oh, it was painted, actually, in a painting called The Orchestra by Edgar Degas. And it was the owner and the person who commissioned this bass, a guy by the name of Plumerel, in 1843, who introduced Degas to the ballet. And as you know, subsequently, Degas became infatuated with the ballet and produced over 300 paintings of the ballet alone in various places. And as partial tribute, perhaps, but he painted his friend and this bass in this painting, which is actually well known. It also features a bassoonist. And in that painting, he was just trying to be nice to his friends. It's an unusual scale. You find the faces of all of these people in this orchestra pit, and they're basically all of his friends, include lawyers and neighbors. And in the background, you see the ballet dancers because it wasn't yet featured in his mind. And later he became obsessed with it. But I inherited this bass. Well, it was offered to me when it used to belong to my former teacher, who played for New York City Ballet and taught at Juilliard. And when he passed away, his widow offered it to me. And I got it by coincidence just a few days before the 75th anniversary performance of the San Francisco Ballet. So this particular instrument, and the provenance is well known, was born in the Paris Ballet at the Garnier, had its second life with my teacher with the New York City Ballet, and performed for all of Balanchine's works, and now is here in San Francisco Ballet. So it's an unusual history, kind of rooted in ballet.
Well-traveled bass.
Yeah, well, as all instruments are, I think, but few have quite the colorful history or is documented by such a painter.
Well, let's listen to another selection from Raku. What would you suggest?
Perhaps maybe that we can go to the chant. This would be the chanted by the San Francisco Zen Center, and it's a bit of a story how that came to be, but perhaps we can listen to it first. What they are chanting is called the Enmei Juku Kanen Gyo, and it loosely translates to, we are here to listen to your suffering, and we chant for your well-being.
And that's the chant section from Raku by our guest, Shinji Eshima, the ballet score being performed by the San Francisco Ballet at the War Memorial Opera House now. And well, tell us the story now about this.
I think it's kind of amazing. It came to me rather indirectly. I had intentionally asked for the orchestra to chant, and they were only going to chant Namo through their instruments, actually. But I teach at the conservatory here in both the pre-college and the adult extension. And I was fortunate enough to have an adult student by the name of Paul Grantham, and who wanted to study bass. And a very interesting character. And it just so turns out we had a conversation once about the fact that I was composing this ballet and I was struggling with this one scene. And it turns out that he's on the board of directors of the San Francisco Zen Center, and he also practices meditation and knows of chanting. So he offered, he said, well, maybe I could bring this up with the Zen Center here. And they came, all of them, in their formal robes, and we had 12 of them. The Zen Center is very close by to the Opera House, and I didn't expect them to chant anything particularly, but they came and offered this particular chant, and they know it from memory, so I didn't even have to have the music out for them or anything. And the fact that they've been doing this for centuries, almost daily, chanting this chant, which aids actually in healing of the world, I think is such a beautiful aesthetic. And also when Raku has now been on tour, for instance, when we went on tour to Los Angeles, They themselves contacted the Los Angeles Zen Center and got together a group of their members to chant. And Raku apparently is now going to Europe, and the Zen Center again is collecting their members to come to chant for this ballet, essentially around the world.
Wow.
And it's just so marvelous. They want, I mean, for them to expose what they do with a totally different audience, I think, is fantastic. And in return, this happens to be their 50th anniversary season, so year, and I'm writing some music now to help celebrate that.
Well, I'm just wondering if writing this piece now for the full orchestra, has it given you a taste for that you may want to write some more for full orchestra?
I love it, yeah. It's painstaking and it's infuriating at times, but the freedom to do this with it's like the ultimate canvas, and having any color at your disposal is just brilliant. I like using the available instruments within the orchestra. I didn't go really outside the orchestra's standard instruments to do this score, although some people have described it as sounding somewhat Japanese or having ethnic sounds in it. But I wanted to use what was there. So the answer to your question is right. And if we have time, this another selection will incorporate more of the full orchestra now. And also a bit of Morse code. The original monk, one speculation that actually Mishima had was the monk was known to stutter, and people thought that perhaps it was his humiliation that he couldn't speak clearly was perhaps one reason why he wanted to burn down this symbol of beauty. And so in the score, to suggest stuttering, I use the marimba playing Morse code, essentially. And the Morse code that is tapped out, it translates to "I love her," suggesting his intentions, at least in this ballet.
Well, why don't we listen to that?
Great. It begins with a bassoon solo written for him, Rufus Olivier, and includes the fight scene where the monk does search out the princess. Thank you.
Night Scene from Raku, the ballet by Yuri Posokov, the score by our guest Shinji Ishimiya, and it's playing now at the San Francisco Ballet at the Opera House. And it's been great to have you on and meet you and talk about the work. It's an amazing score.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's been a real pleasure.
Thanks for being with us. And Raku is performed four more times. The program six at the San Francisco Ballet also includes Ramonda Act 3, choreographed by Rudolf Nureyev, and Guide to Strange Places, the music of John Adams, choreographed by Ashley Page. And the performances are tonight at 8 o'clock, on Saturday both at 2 o'clock and 8 o'clock, and then next Tuesday, April 3rd at 8 p.m. And for ticket information, sfballet.org. And you're listening to Open Air on KALW San Francisco. On to another composer to resume and conclude our conversation with Carl Davis, the composer who assembled the score for the showing of Abel Gance's silent film masterpiece Napoleon for four performances, two last weekend and two coming up this Saturday and Sunday at the Paramount Theater in Oakland. And as we resume this conversation, recorded a while ago, we talk about the presentation of Napoleon this coming weekend. I should mention, too, that this is being presented by the San Francisco Silent Film Festival, a special series of four concerts.
That's right.
And showings.
That's right. It'll be my first visit there. In fact, it's my first visit to the Bay Area, so I'm very, very thrilled to have pointed out to me today, that's the Golden Gate Bridge. That's Alcatraz. Wonderful.
Well, what are the special challenges of creating a score for a silent film as opposed to a score for a talkie?
Well, the basic difference is in that in a talking film, a contemporary film, let's say, there are three factors. In the case of a silent film, the only sound really is the orchestra music that you're going to play. Even if there are sound effects involved in it, you have to make it within the orchestra. In today's world, there are sound effects,
right,
which should be the mimicking the real thing, if not the real thing itself. And there will be dialogue. The music comes third in the creation of a kind of film reality. And so that a lot of your time as composer is actually spent discussing whether there should be music there at all. Of course, we know in the films that have a fantastical nature, like a science fiction film or a Harry Potter or a big action film of a fantastic nature, you know, the music can be run continuously, but they're part of a sound design, so to speak. But in the case of the silence, you are actually writing the equivalent of a full-length ballet or a full-length opera. If a film runs 2 hours, you will be, they would have expected, the audience expectation is that there would be 2 hours of music. And you have to learn how to construct films that are really formed of these large paragraphs so that a music will cover a whole scene or a whole action sequence or something. And, you know, you have to think big. You have to think in big structures. Comedies will tend to be more fragmented. But even so, you think in, as my model, which are Chaplin's own scores that he wrote in the 1930s for films like City Lights and Modern Times, that you have to study where a master of film music, I think, which is Chaplin, will decide that he's going to what we call Mickey Mouse, the kind of music that's used in cartoons where every little action has a little phrase or a little noise to accompany it. But he would alternate sequences where actions are mimicked in that way, with actions that that a whole piece of music starts, and it seems as if the actions are choreographed into the piece of music. So those would tend to be of longer length. And that was a very interesting model for comedy music in particular. But if you get a real drama, you tend to write in long paragraphs, long pieces. A love scene may go on for 4 or 5 minutes, something like the chariot race in the silent Ben-Hur goes on for nearly 11 minutes. And, you have to be able to sustain a piece of music that will go on for that long and be of interest and be meaningful for the character and content of the film.
Well, let me go back a step further and ask you how you got into music and composing music in the first place.
In particular, for a film, you mean?
No,
or just in general?
Right, in general.
Well, it had always been part of the picture. I mean, I started playing piano very early. My mother played piano. We always had an instrument, which is a very important aspect of it. I was entranced by film as soon as I could be taken to the pictures, which is from the age of 4. The early Disneys were my model. In particular, when I started playing the piano, Fantasia, which was a very good thing to take a child to see because it shows kind of what the components of music are in graphic illustration. As I studied and got more capable on the piano, I began to compose. I mean, it just seemed something quite natural that, I want to write that, and I want to write, I'll set those poems, and I'll, want to do this, and I want to, I'll write an opera, And then it lessened a bit, and I focused more on playing, and so it came out of that. And then I had a moment, which was a sort of chemical moment, I've learned, rather than a vision from above or below, where I really wanted to play, which is when I was 18. I really wanted to compose, rather. I really wanted to compose from the time I was 18. And then from there on in, I was focused on composing, even though I did get begin a career as a performer within the world of opera in particular. I more or less ended that when I was 23 on going to Europe. And from that point, 1960 to 1980, with the premiere of Napoleon, I was composing and not performing or playing.
Was it, I guess, in those years it was that Europe is more hospitable for a young composer or conductor, American?
Well, then it seems so.
Country. Yeah.
It seems so. I think the picture is different today. At any rate, the perspective was for me in my 20s, who was sort of not rejecting America, but really exactly, but sort of saying, I don't know what I could do here that I could succeed with. I don't know if I'm asked to, would somebody be thinking of a 13-hour series on the history of silent film or making adaptations of Jane Austen or Charles Dickens or Thomas Hardy novels and asking me to write extended scores for those? And doing it with the kind of music I was writing, which was very, very based on Central European classical music of the 19th and 20th century. It didn't fit the formula of film music per se, or what was done. It was much more related to classical music in the concert or operatic sense. So I thought that it was the right move. Looking back, I thought it was the right move. I don't think I missed out on anything here.
What was the first silent film score that you were asked to create?
Napoleon.
Oh, that was the
that
very
was
first...
number one.
It was.
That was number one, and 60 followed. in the 30-odd years, there was an incredible amount of work done by, and I'm still writing them. I'm still good. We're going to have a premiere in May with an orchestra I've been coming to almost every year called the Los Angeles Chamber Orchestra, who stage a charity performance. And even though they're a classical orchestra, they do a charity gala in Los Angeles, which is very, very frequented by the film community, to see a silent film with their orchestra playing.
Oh, I didn't realize that the LH Chamber Orchestra did that.
Yes, Yes, and we've been mostly doing comedies in the last year because they tend to be smaller scale. But yes, we've done a lot of work together in the last 20 years. It began. I came over in 89 was the first one I did, and when I did City Lights, and this idea of actually playing these mature Chaplin films with Chaplin's own music was we dared to do it.
Well, no. Let me ask about another facet of your career, and that's your association with the Beatles and the Beatles music.
Yeah, that was is interesting, and it still goes on in a way. The real moment, aside from being in London during those years of their existence. And at first, rather despising it, or just thinking that it wasn't anything unusual or interesting, even, and then getting to like them when they became really quite a force. I think really starting with the film, with the Hard Day's Night, and on there, though they were highly successful before that. Of being asked in the meantime, all this is post Napoleon and having a conducting career as well, and being with a great deal of the time with the Royal Liverpool Philharmonic Orchestra, who asked me in 1988 about an idea for a way to celebrate their 150th anniversary as an orchestra, which was going to be in 1991. And would I have an idea? Did I have an idea for something unusual, aside from that they would do Beethoven 9 and Mahler's and Verdi Requiems and so on, the biggies to celebrate. And I said, well, you know, Liverpool's most successful composer is Paul McCartney. You know, what about something with him? And so they liked the idea, of course. You know, that immediately sounded very newsworthy and so on. But it was a question of whether he would or not. You know, he was used to composing three-minute songs, you know, and we were sort of saying, well, you know, here we go. We have a full-scale symphony orchestra of 80-odd. We've got a big chorus if we want. We have solos if we want. The premiere will be at this huge Anglican cathedral in Liverpool, you know. So it depends, you know, we can do something that's 3 minutes or 30 minutes or 60 minutes, you know, or whatever. And so he was intrigued with the idea. I did get to him through various devious ways, but I got to him, and he knew about me anyway because I'd begin, you know, had quite a lot of publicity from World at War on through the television things, through the silent films. So we spent, you know, we accepted the idea, and we together collaborated on this work. Then we did it in 91, and it had a few years, within about 3 or 4 years, it had actually achieved over 100 performances worldwide, and it sent me around the world conducting it, and I did the American premiere at Carnegie Hall a few months later, which was very exciting for me, because, you know, you grew up in New York, you know, how do you get to play in Carnegie Hall?
Right.
Well, you write something with Paul McCartney, and he brings it over. So that was kind of exciting for me on a kind of autobiographical level. Then, you know, he did his thing, I did his thing. He had the tragedy of losing Linda, and the tragedy of a second marriage. But he kept writing. He kept writing and writing and writing. And so, you know, we've clocked each other over the years and so on. And then in the last few years, I decided to form, because of the peculiar ways the record industry go on, I thought, wait a minute, I'm after years of doing a lot of recording, I'm suddenly doing no recording. And you know, and there was this crisis thing, which is part engendered to people's buying habits, the coming of the web and the World Wide Web and shopping on the web and so on, and being able to download, being able to do all these things, which are now very common practice. And I thought, you know, what do I do? What, you know, what can I do at this stage of my life? After, you know, once I was past 70, I think I should record more, you know, and how did one do that? And the common practice today is, of course, you form your own company, you know, and find a distributor, and off you go, you know, into the jungle of early capitalism. You know, we make something and we try and sell it, you know, but through this extraordinary means. And so I joined that band And principally devoted to my own film and television, and now by which time, in the last 20 years, I've been doing a lot of work with ballet. And so there were a number of ballets that were in repertoire of companies. I'm very, very excited by working in dance. Very excited. I love it. And so that became part of the things I would record. And then I began to think of, well, what about my concert repertoire? What should I do? And I had this funny request from Liverpool, the Liverpool Orchestra, saying to me, you know, we're the Royal Liverpool Philharmonic Orchestra. We go all over the world, and people expect us to play Beatles, but we have nothing to play. You know, so I said, well, that's a good idea for my record company. Let's record the Royal Liverpool Philharmonic play the Beatles.
Right, yes.
You know, and it will be purely instrumental. Because with the constant reissuing and now downloading of the original Beatles things, I mean, there's nothing better than that on this material. That is authentically it. But the tunes mean something. The tunes can be produced in a way that would be very telling. I said, and that's what I think I'll go for. I'll go, forget about singing. We're just going to do adaptations of the songs, the particular songs that have a strong enough melodic line or melodic character to be fun as instrumental pieces to play. So I've just done it. That's my latest release. It's just come out, end of July. And, it looks good. It's looking good. We're getting a lot of hits. And, of course, it can be downloaded and a lot of fun. And I do it as a concert. So I combine the two careers. So I do the Beatles in concert, just as I've done James Bond in concert and things like that. And they're entwined. They're entwined. They support each other.
Well, now, tell us about the ballet work.
The ballet is wonderful because, again, growing up in New York, I was in at the beginning of and seeing the New York City Ballet in their earliest things. There was Ballet Russe de Monte Carlo. There was ballet theater. They all had been stranded. The European companies had all been stranded here by World War II. So America reaped the benefit, as it did in so many ways, of the European exodus of their artists and of their companies. Martha Graham, also another obsession of mine, and I was always, it was one of the most stimulating things, and my dream was always to be writing for ballet, which I not that many after Graham composers asked to write ballets. If scores are found, they generally are because they heard it on a record, you know. And so it took a long time in England, which is a very lively dance scene, to be involved. But finally, by the mid-80s, I began kind of also stimulated by the silent film, that people knew more of me as live, as writing to length and so on. So at the moment, I have got a ballet of the Christmas Carol of Dickens that has been done every year for 20 years by a company called the Northern Ballet Theatre. I have a ballet based on Aladdin that was done originally in Scotland, but now has been taken up by the National Ballet of Japan, and it's done there. It was called Aladdin. And it's been taken up now by the Birmingham Royal Ballet and is going to be produced also in 2014 by the Houston Ballet. So I'm getting nearer, I have an Alice in Wonderland ballet that was done by the English National Ballet and also produced by the Pittsburgh Ballet. And so it is a lot of fun. And I have a ballet of the Lady of the Camellias. That's my most recent. That was done by the National Ballet of Croatia, which I hope will get beyond, you know, once Croatia joins the EU, they'll have enough money to go further with it. At the moment, they're bust.
Well, it's an amazing career, and I really appreciate having this chance to talk with you about it.
And we can play some tracks as well.
Yes. Thanks for being with us, Carl Davis.
Goodbye. Thank you.
Composer and conductor Carl Davis, who's created the score for Napoleon, he'll be conducting the Oakland East Bay Symphony for the final two performances this weekend at the Paramount Theater in Oakland. And for information, silentfilm.org. And we'll conclude this program by listening to one of the songs from the Beatles for Orchestra CD with the Royal Liverpool Philharmonic, Carl Davis conducting A Day in the Life.
Thank you.
A Day in the Life, as arranged by C. Egan and A. Vinter, and as recorded by the Royal Liverpool Philharmonic, conducted by our guest, Carl Davis. And the CD is The Beatles for Orchestra, Carl Davis conducting the Royal Liverpool Philharmonic Orchestra. And that's Open Air for this week. I'm Alan Farley. Thank you for listening. I'm Alan Farley, and on the next Book Talk, I'll be talking with Leslie Tenorio about his new collection of short stories, Monstress, stories that have been described as poignant, imaginative, but somehow sad and funny all at once. Sad and funny all at once. That's Leslie Tenorio on the next Book Talk, only on KALW, Sunday at 6:30 p.m.
Tonight on Out in the Bay, lawyers and taxes and bonds. Oh no! Inequality hits same-sex couples right in the assets. Federal laws require discrimination in taxes, pensions, real estate, and more. Financial advisor Mark Grace and estate attorney Susan Von Herman fill us in on the extra steps queer people must take to protect their families financially. They'll also give practical tips for anyone, including straight folks, in relationships not recognized by the U.S. government. I'm Eric Jansen. Join us Out in the Bay tonight at 7.
Right here on your local public radio station, KALW, San Francisco. News Hour from the BBC is next. It was recorded during the past hour. The time is 2 o'clock.
BBC World Service, this is James Kumarasamy with News Hour. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, the French Muslim who killed 7 people is buried in Toulouse after a row over the location of his grave.
He was French. Let him be buried, and let's not argue about it.
A general strike in Spain over proposals to tighten up the country's labour laws. Supporters of the coup in Mali force 5 African presidents to call off their visit to the country. Why petrol and pasties are leaving Britain's Prime Minister in a pickle. And a new exhibition that takes a physical look inside our heads.
The brain, of course, is a famously gelatinous tissue. It's very soft. It has roughly the consistency of blancmange.
First, the main news in detail.